the Atlantic to the Pacific, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here. One of our special sort of Halloween editions of the program. We like to do these in October, and tonight we're going to dig this hour into the subjects of, vampires and the occult. Let me start by saying that a lot of people who live in this area may not know this little story I'll give you. In 1774, there was a judge and land developer here in North Carolina named Richard Henderson. And back in those days, most of what we now know of as the United States of America was actually what they called Indian territory. And so it was kind of up for grabs if you could go out and stake a claim and defend it properly in most cases. And so there were a lot of these land speculators who did just that. Well, Richard Henderson was one of these guys, and he had heard of some land up north the Indians called Kentucky, which, of course, we would now call Kentucky. And he had heard that it was plentiful for hunting and various resources, and so he wanted to send a scout to go out across the forest, across the wilderness, to check it out. So he formed a company called the Transylvania Company. Because in Latin, trans means across, and Sylvania means the woods or the forest. So Transylvania means across the woods. And he hired a scout, a man you've probably heard of, named Daniel Boone. And Daniel Boone went to Kentucky. He ended up settling an area called Boonesboro. He got into all kinds of trouble with Indians, had this amazing, dramatic, volatile series of adventures and misadventures. And just when it seemed like this might end up being a success, there was some kind of a legal problem that cropped up about how Richard Henderson had taken this land. And eventually the newly formed United States government decided to remove his claim to that land. And so, disappointed, Richard Henderson instead decided to develop some land closer to home here in North Carolina. So he took his Transylvania company, and he developed a piece of property we now know as Transylvania County. So that is why we have a county called Transylvania that borders Buncombe County, from where I am broadcasting right now. And therefore, there is no direct connection between the Transylvania of Romania and Transylvania County, aside from the Latin name. But it is odd how so many spooky things kind of happen around Transylvania County. I think it attracts a lot of eccentric people, curious sorts. And I also find it interesting that in old Europe, there are tales in Transylvania and other places about, say, witches and vampires having familiars or shape-shifting forms that include white animals like white wolves or white owls. And Transylvania County is famous for their white squirrels. Coincidence? Who knows? But they do have, say, a vampire 5K they do there every year. I think this year they turned it into a vampire 10K. So people have fun with it, and there are some interesting connections. But when you take the new Asheville Vampire and Occult Tour, we start off by kind of digging into some of the connections between Western North Carolina and the old European culture, and how that, believe it or not, there are many different vampiric and occult and Wiccan and pagan things, of course, that have integrated into this amazing little city we call Asheville. So you get to learn about and experience all that. And this new tour, it was quite an endeavor to create. And, you know, you can go into just about any bar and ask the bartender for a ghost story, and he'll tell you one. You have to do some very extensive research, however, to find good substantive content for a vampire and occult tour in this city. And this tour talks about the true agenda of the Freemasons, the witch's tree in our city county plaza, the bizarre creature that terrorized the jail inmates in 1908, some buildings in our town that are supposedly demon-possessed and whatnot. So in order to create this tour, it became immediately apparent that the guy to work with was Mr. Tad McDivitt. He told you about his background earlier in the program, and so Tad and I began working together, and we have co-developed this tour, which is truly unique, original, and groundbreaking for this area. So that said, Tad, when we talk about vampires, instead of just talking about Bela Lugosi in a cape, what is a vampire? What are we talking about?
Well, there's a lot of legends far and wide. The classical vampire, of course, comes from Transylvania and the Romania area. But when you broaden the horizons, instead of fixating on particularly that concept, you've got this idea that there are creatures that can draw power or need to survive based on the life force of other things. You know, we have parasites in the real world. We get the concept. But the idea of having to consume something, like over in the Far East, there is a myth of a creature called a Kwaijin, who do the same thing, except instead of your blood, it is your chi, your more metaphysical life force. Over here in the Americas, Native American tribal legend of a creature called a Wendigo, which is kind of like a cannibalism spirit up in the frosty north. And they believe that this spirit would drive people insane, and that you would drive you to eat other people in the middle of the winter, and in the act of doing so, you would become yourself a Wendigo. So, you know, it's not even just European mythology. There's a lot of legends in a whole lot of different cultures about monsters that sustain themselves on the life force of others, and in a lot of these legends, a human being becomes one of those creatures through the act of eating another person.
You know, I think it's really also fascinating to look at some of these legends and reinterpret them through the eyes of modern physics and modern medicine. And one thing that, you know, I'm fond of bringing up on the tour is that I know a lot of people who from time to time consume colloidal silver. And a colloid is a molecule that is evenly dispersed in a liquid solution. And I myself take colloidal silver from time to time, and that's because it's been known for thousands of years. Silver actually is an antibiotic. And it was used in the old days to prevent milk from going bad. You'd put a silver coin in a bottle of milk, or even sailors would put a silver coin in a jar of wine to keep it from going bad on long sails. Long journeys. When surgery was performed, it was common to put something silver in the wound before you sewed it up. To this day, in some very poor countries like parts of India, when you buy a sandwich, they will serve you that sandwich in a silver wrapper as opposed to an aluminum foil wrapper to help keep it germ-free, and they reuse those over and over. And so, you know, silver, it truly has this property. In fact, you know, one of the little factoids we discussed is that a lot of the old royals would eat off of very pure silverware, and they stayed very healthy by doing that. But after they consumed too much of it over time, their skin would often take on a bluish tint, which is where the term blue bloods comes from. And the ancients, they didn't understand germs. They didn't have microscopes. I mean, that's a relatively modern discovery that germs are responsible for sickness. They just knew that silver had some almost magical property to defeat death and decay. And I believe that since vampires were associated with this idea of decay and that parasitic element that you described, it was believed that silver implements could be used to kill and defeat vampires and werewolves, which are related. And some of the earliest mirrors were pieces of glass that had a silver solution on the back to produce a reflective surface. And if a vampire is a negative energy field that is repelled by silver, then that may be why we believe that vampires cannot cast a reflection, that their very energy is repelled by the silver itself. And if you look at the silver myth on its own, it may just seem like some totally bizarre aspect of folklore that doesn't have any practical benefit. But you look at it that way, and you say, oh, I can understand how the people who lived 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago might draw that connection. And I think that when we are looking at this idea of vampires and other beings, that's kind of the way we're trying to approach them, right, Ted?
Absolutely. In fact, I tend to point out that before the discovery of microorganisms, most tribal cultures attributed sickness and infection to evil spirits and demons.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was last year in Washington, D.C., at the Crime and Punishment Museum there. And when you walk in the door, one of the first things you see is Ted Bundy's murder car. And it's a Volkswagen bug. And, I mean, it's very creepy because he'd removed one of the seats so that when he would hit a woman in the head, he could kind of cram her down there and nobody would see her as he drove off. And so the car was an integral murder weapon, and he was such a vicious guy. But at one point in the courtroom, he actually declared, quote, "Sometimes I feel like a vampire," end quote. Mm-hmm. And they even used some of his teeth marks to prove that he killed some of these victims. And it makes you wonder, you know, Ted Bundy, he escaped from jail one time by almost, you know, he shimmied through some incredibly small space. Do you think there are people out there who might literally be able to eventually shapeshift and take on powers because they indulge in more life energy?
Who knows? There might be something to it. You know, I mean, from our perspective, cannibalism is such a taboo. It's not exactly like we do tests to see what the effects are. You know, from our concept, it's absolutely immoral. So who knows what kind of physiological changes consuming other people do?
Because we change little by little every day. We call it aging. Mm-hmm. It's usually a slow process, but our physical bodies can change, and therefore, if you have a little bit more of that life energy because you're taking it from others, does that give you an accelerated ability to change your physical structure? We got to take a break here. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about vampires and how some of this stuff relates to Asheville. And then we'll just start hitting these other topics, you know, conspiracies, witchcraft, witch's tree, some of the bizarre little creatures that we have heard about terrorizing people in this town. And that's why you should definitely come and experience this new Asheville Vampire and Occult Tour. We don't know how long we're going to offer it. It definitely will take place every Saturday at 8 p.m. for a while. But if you can't make it on Saturdays, contact us and let us know when you can, and maybe we can work with you. Details are at hauntedasheville.com. I'm Joshua P. Warren. We will continue this conversation right after this. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. Somber, and in the murky gloom, arisen from his slumber, the vampire leaves his tomb. His eyes are pools of fire, his skin is icy white, and blood his one desire, this woe-begotten night. Then through the silent city, he makes his silent way, prepared to take no pity upon his hapless prey. An open window beckons. He grins a hungry grin. And pausing not one second, he swiftly climbs within. And there, beneath her covers, his victim lies in sleep. With fangs agleam he hovers, and with those fangs bites deep. The vampire drinks till sated, he fills his every pore, and then his thirst abated, licks clean the dripping gore. With powers now replenished, his thirst no longer burns, his quest this night is finished. So to his tomb he turns. And there, a while in silence, he'll rest beneath the mud until with thoughts of violence he wakes and utters, "Blood." The Vampire. Nightmares, Poems to Trouble Your Sleep by Jack Polutsky. That's what we're talking about tonight. Vampires and the occult on this Halloween edition of the show. In the studio with Tad McDivitt, occult researcher, published author, and co-creator of the new Asheville Vampire and Occult Tour. Tad is involved with all aspects of the Asheville Mystery Museum. If you've been there, you know him well. And how exactly does all this vampire business relate to our town of Asheville, North Carolina, Tad?
Well, there's several connections. First off, Asheville has, for many years now, been a town where that has a lot of drifters coming and going. There have been a lot of missing persons along this underground of drifters. And generally, a lot of the missing persons that happen around Asheville aren't permanent residents that are connected to the community. Generally, when seedy things happen, it's transients. And I kind of made the connection that if there were a stalking predator walking our streets, they're not going to hit the local faces that everyone knows. It's much more safe. It's a lot easier to not get caught if you're picking off the transients that are coming and going. Because, first off, even if they do find out that this person is gone, finding information about them or what they've been doing is a little trickier because, well, they might be hanging out in shadier areas doing shadier things, and no one's going to want to admit to these kinds of going-ons. There's also the underground.
Right.
You know, you've done a lot of research on the underground. I remember you used to even do a tour.
Yeah, we did a few underground Asheville tours taking people below the city streets.
Yeah, and, you know, as a lot of people know, there is this huge network of underground tunnels underneath Asheville. And underground places like that are really a classic vampire lair or a haven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we were to think about it hypothetically, it would be very easy for a nocturnal creature to make his way all about the place during the daytime because there are so many networks of tunnels that would completely keep something shielded from the sun.
Absolutely. And of course, we won't go too deeply into this because it's such a great story, but when I was writing Haunted Asheville, I was just astounded to discover this story from 1908, when the men of the Buncombe County Jail were terrorized by some weird little creature. And you've even discussed this on this program before.
As a matter of fact, I have.
And we've always been scratching our heads over what this little creature was. It bared its teeth. It had this little goblin-esque appearance. It's swinging on the cages. And we even have now sort of looked at that story and realized that there may be a very clear vampiric element that maybe in 1908, the people who were describing this thing would not have jumped onto the term vampire like we would today.
Right.
But I think that could have been a vampiric creature that even has some origins in European folklore.
So I think, yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, if you come on the tour and you get the details on this, Tad describes what he found out about this one part of Europe connected to this incident. And when you tell this story, I don't know why, but I just get the chills every time I hear you tell it. When you bring up your explanation for these little creatures and who they are and what they do, the vision that I conjure up in my mind is really unsettling.
Well, this is one of the things that, you know, studying so much mythology and folklore, you know, when you compare it to modern paranormal researchers,
mm-hmm.
the popular subjects these get these days are aliens, ghosts, and demons.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh my gosh, the folklore and legends of so many cultures, there are so many creatures. I mean, it's a cryptozoologist smorgasbord
mm-hmm.
of inhuman creatures of large and small sizes in almost every culture. Europe especially tends to be very thick. In fact, a little, as we were talking about this over our last tour, believe it or not, over in Iceland, there is still a law on the books to where if a construction company wants to tear down some forests and build a commercial center, they have to hire medium specialists who go out into that field and determine if there are any imps or fairies out in the woods before they tear it down. And, you know, sure, Walt Disney has given us this image of Tinkerbell, and us using the term fairy tale has become synonymous with blatant fictitiousness. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, there's this whole side of cryptozoology and enormous amounts of sightings, you know, all over the world of small creatures that very well could fit into the category of goblins and trolls and the darker side, the Grimm's side of the fairy tale myths.
And it's funny because when we're walking around downtown Asheville on an October night, there are moments when, you know, usually you and I, when we do this, we wear a cape or a cloak.
Right.
We try to transport people back in time. And there are moments when, you know, you'll be standing there next to a church or a tree or something, and it looks like we're on a movie set.
It does. Especially, you know, when the wind hits the cloaks just right.
Yeah, the wind's blowing, the church bell starts bonging in the distance, and I say bonging, especially in Asheville. And, I mean, the setting is so great. If you go to hauntedasheville.com and you click the link, you can see some pictures of Tad and myself giving this tour, and of course Tad is the guy who usually does the tour, and there's a picture of you, Tad, in your cloak standing next to what we call the witch's tree,
right,
downtown. Let's talk a little about that, and when we talk about witch, when you talk about witch, what are you really talking about?
Well, see, it gets a slippery because there's what the word meant 100 years ago, and then there's what the word means now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I actually kind of, personally, I think that the concept of a priest, a witch, a shaman, they're all arguably different cultures' terms for the same thing.
Right.
A wise person who guides us and is aware of the higher powers in the universe. You know, so, yeah, 50 years ago, a witch was an evil spellcaster who worshipped the devil. But these days, there is this huge push in the Wiccan movement,
mm-hmm.
and it is a very old-fashioned tribal nature worship, and I'm close friends with a ton of them that live here in Asheville, you know. So when it comes to specifically witches, that's one of the phrases that I like to try and take away the negative connotations from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most witches I know personify the divine in a female way. They're very into the earth and nature and ecology, and there is absolutely nothing trying to harm other people about them.
Mm-hmm.
Also, on the subject of a witch, there's a lot of folklore attached to it. I mean, back in the day, any older, wise woman might have been called a witch by the community.
Mm-hmm.
Learned a little interesting story. You know, you always hear about the long claw-ish fingernails that witches are supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the origin of that comes from midwives.
Mm-hmm.
Older midwives in rural areas who often had to attend pregnancies would keep their pinky nail about an inch long so that they'd have something to tear the caul.
Ooh.
During, you know, to help with the birthing process, you know. So there's all kinds of little idiosyncrasies regarding the witch and witchcraft legends, which is actually just homeopathic health practices.
Wow.
You know, it's just years and years of religious strife and theology have demonized certain concepts.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, since we're talking about witches, I think it's interesting to sort of bring up the connection between witches and witchcraft and cats and dogs, something that I learned about long ago and studied extensively when I was doing the book on pet ghosts. You know, there's a part of the Bible that says, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live," and that was used as justification to murder maybe millions of people, especially women, for hundreds of years. We'll talk about all that and more when we come back. It's the Halloween edition, one of, well, two or three we do this time of year. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the show where the unusual becomes usual. Speaking of strange. By night in fearsome flight, in garments black as pitch, the queen of doom upon her broom, the wild and wicked witch. A cackling crone with brittle bones and desiccated limbs, two evil eyes with warts and styes and bags about the rims. A dangling nose, 10 twisted toes and folds of shriveled skin, cracked and chipped with crackled lips that frame a toothless grin. She hurtles by, she sweeps the sky, and hurls a piercing screech. As she swoops past, a spell is cast on all her curses reach. Take care to hide when the wild witch rides to shriek her evil spell. What she may do with a word or two is much too grim to tell. The Wicked Witch. Nightmares, poems to trouble your sleep, against the danse macabre. Sans same, welcome back to Speaking of Strange. Glad that you've chosen to spend this October evening with us, joining you from the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains, Asheville, North Carolina, land of the sky. You know, there was a book written in the late 1400s called the Malleus Maleficarum, The Hammer of Witches. And this book, produced by a couple of friars, was used for centuries to instruct people on how to identify, prosecute, torture women suspected of being witches. And it's so sensational. I mean, its sale at the time was only rivaled by the Bible itself. And you know, we hear about all of these women who obviously didn't have all these crazy dark powers, who were put through horrific ordeals. I love the movie The Crucible, the version that was done with Daniel Day-Lewis. You know, if you haven't seen that, I highly recommend it. But in this book, The Malleus Maleficarum, it is stated quite clearly that at times, witches can literally transform into cats. And there is even a story that's given about a woodcutter who was attacked by a bunch of cats. And afterward, he reported to the town authorities that these had to be some witches who lived down the road. And so they agreed, and they prosecuted them and killed them. So the point is made in The Hammer of Witches that cats are the preferred creature of the witch because they are perfidious. That is to say, tending to betray. They have this sort of dark independence about them. On the other hand, inversely, dogs are thought to be divine creatures, the companions of the godly, because dogs are devoted and trustworthy. And that is where some of this classic rivalry between cats and dogs comes from. It's directly tied to the ideas associated with witchcraft. And Tad McDivitt, how prevalent are these tales of familiars and shape-shifting and these animal connections to this type of lore.
Oh, very much. Although that particular story makes me wonder if the friars had ever heard of a hellhound.
Yeah, right. Good point.
There are plenty of stories about malevolent canines.
Sure.
Oh, very much so. And that, I think, is a connection to tribal animism.
Okay.
You know, a lot of these myths and legends go back to a tribal way of viewing things where they really, you know, you got that animistic totem spirit kind of idea, you know. We're very familiar with it in American and South American lore, but before Christianity swept through Europe, the old Celtic and Norse cultures were very tribal, very animistic. And, you know, their gods had animals that went with them. There were different animals that were supposed to mean different attributes. Bears mean strength. Eagles mean splendor and majesty. You know, the entire phenomena of European crests as different families, you know, is an expression of this animistic sense where different animals are meant to represent different virtues, and therefore likely also other animals are going to represent different vices.
Speaking of this tribal element, one of the things that we talk about on this tour is Asheville's now famous drum circle.
Very much. In fact, I heard that there is an advertisement in the Sky Mall magazine about Asheville, that they mention the Biltmore House and then they mention the drum circle. And when I heard about that, I was like, okay, I didn't know the drum circle was that much of a pull, but I guess so.
Yeah, it sort of, I guess it shows that full spectrum of activity and attraction here.
Right.
And you know, if you go down to the drum circle, and I know if you've never seen the drum circle, it doesn't sound like anything special, but when you go there, there is a feeling. It's packed out.
Oh, yeah.
And you hear it from far away. You hear it resonating off the buildings.
Oh, yeah. When you're walking downtown, you know, it's thundering echo.
And so as you get closer and closer, there's kind of this dramatic buildup as you reach the center. And when you get to the center, you don't know what you're going to see.
Nope.
You know there are going to be people dancing, and they're going to be out of their mind, and they're entering some weird state of mind. I'm sure a lot of them are taking shrooms and stuff. Who knows?
I can guarantee it with those dreadlocks and hula hoops.
Yeah. They've got lights, you know, various glow sticks and things like that. You see people ringing the outskirts who are doing performance art of various kind. And the funny thing is, you could go there and look at this from a very strict conservative fundamentalist point of view and say, oh, look, it's an orgy of hedonism taking place. But at the same time, I see, like, parents with their kids, and they're clearly tourists, and they take their kids out, and they dance around with the kids, and everybody's, it's good family fun, and it's so weird to see all that combined in one place. So what's happening when these drum beats are resonating through our city?
Well, this is a ceremonial custom that crosses so many different cultures, the concept that drums wake and rouse spirits. You know, drums, for that reason, the drums are used on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
Meant to rouse and lull and inspire, you know, both the spirits leading you to war, but as well as the adrenaline and psych out the warriors themselves. So, you know, percussions and drum beats have always had this quality in a lot of cultures. New Orleans voodoo culture does this, Native American tribal cultures, African cultures, Indian cultures, so many different cultures use percussion as a spiritual ceremony meant to shock and wake spirits. Now, the dancing is the next layer. Dancing in many cultures, literally, they believe that when you start dancing, you open your body up for a spirit to come inside of you. And, I mean, these days we've got horror movies about possession and that kind of thing, but there are a lot of religions. Even Christians say, I'm filled with the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a precedent set for a opening yourself up for a positive spirit that is entering your body that is meant to help your life, your fortune, and your sense of fulfillment and health. So you've got the drums, and you've got the dancing, and the entire making a circle, which is, again, a very mystical ritual. Circles, in, oh golly, everything from masonry to modern Wicca uses circles as a metaphor for a boundary.
Mm-hmm.
So in the making the circle, they create a boundary, and the idea is that within that circle, what our energy, what we throw out is what's going to be there. So you've got this, you know, this huge circle, which is a symbolic metaphor. You've got the drums that get, that do literally get everybody's active. They get their, you know, adrenaline glands going. And I think that quite possibly this might be part of the feeling. Maybe that rousing the spirits is really working. And then the dancing starts, you know, and it's kind of funny because you brought up mushrooms, but it's worth pointing out that also hand in hand with these kinds of ceremonies in tribal cultures are alcohol and other mind-altering substances, which is also meant to kind of help you lose yourself to make room for the spirit that's going to be entering you. So, you know, so many different cultures would combine drums, dance, circle, fire, and some kind of mind-altering thing that they would ingest or imbibe.
And one thing that's kind of odd is the contrast when you're on the route and you pass the drum circle after you are moving away and it's becoming a little quieter and quieter. Then we turn a corner onto Church Street
and it becomes quiet and still.
And here we have these big, stately, you know, beautiful churches with dramatic lighting on them, and it's sort of the opposite of the drum circle, really.
It's a shocking difference of mood within half a block.
So what is the significance of faith when it comes to combating evil forces?
Well, that's, I dare say, this is the one thing that almost every religion on the planet agrees on.
Mm-hmm.
You fight malevolent spirits with faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the King James Bible says so, the Quran says so, the Torah says so, Buckland's Complete Guide to Witchcraft says so, you know, the Tao Te Ching says so. If the entire idea that if there are ephemeral spiritual forces, some of them benevolent, some of them malevolent, well, the idea is that if something malevolent is after you, your faith will be the beacon that brings forth the benevolent protector spirits. Christians pray and completely believe that an angel is coming to their defense to help them against whatever malevolent spirit. You know, we don't necessarily consider that witchcraft, but that is very much a very normal part of a lot of 21st century people's lives, to call upon the positive to protect themselves from the negative.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will wrap up this hour by talking some about conspiracies like those associated with the Freemasons. I mean, our tour leaves from the Asheville Masonic Temple. It takes you inside. A lot of people have never been inside a building like this before. What is the true agenda of Freemasonry? I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the program where we dig into the amazing, the remarkable, the extraordinary, the show where the unusual becomes usual, keeping you company tonight. It's called Speaking of Strain. the final minutes of tonight's hour number two. You are listening to Speaking of Strange. Coming up next hour, well, we call it the Dark 30 Hour. Not for the kiddies, not for the easily offended. Next hour is when we dig into some of the more outrageous and controversial news as of late. So if that's not for you, just tune out and come back an hour later, because it's stuff that we only feel comfortable talking about late at night. Right now, we are wrapping up a conversation about the brand new Asheville Vampire and Occult Tour, created by Tad McDivitt and myself. And as of right now, it is guaranteed to leave every Saturday night at 8 p.m. However, because this month is so active, if you cannot make it on a Saturday for some reason, well, contact us and we'll see what we can work out for you. All the details are at hauntedasheville.com. And one of the things that's so special about this tour is that we also take you inside the Asheville Masonic Temple at night, and you at very least get to go down to the Mystery Museum, see some of the artifacts that I brought back from Transylvania there on display. And a lot of people have never been inside a Masonic temple, and especially one of this magnitude. It's a beautiful building. And a lot of people have understandable confusion about Freemasonry. Tad, if somebody asks you simply enough, what is Freemasonry? How do you answer that?
A brotherhood who tries to do a lot of charity. That's probably the most straightforward answer.
Mm-hmm. And it is true. There have been amazing Masonic conspiracies. But what is the biggest Masonic conspiracy that you know about?
The American Revolution.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thomas Jefferson, arguably. Definitely George Washington. Definitely Ben Franklin. A lot of the founding fathers were Masons. And King George knew it. And when they drafted the Declaration of Independence, had the First Continental Congress, without a shadow of a doubt, that was a conspiracy against King George II.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt. You know, that's something everybody knows. But, you know, our relationship with England is so good these days, we don't really think about how us declaring our revolution, our independence, and having that revolution was quite the conspiracy in the global political arena at the time.
And it's odd because generally Masons are not supposed to discuss politics or religion in lodge.
Yep.
And yet I think sometimes when these, you know, critical moments occur in history, the guys who are Masons, they have a similar belief system, and they naturally sort of congregate and say, we know we can trust each other to work together to make the world a better place, which is exactly what happened in the American Revolution. That's what we say now. Back then, those men were considered terrorists by the royalty in Europe.
Another thing to keep in mind is going back to the Victorian era, you know, Masons had this very interesting relationship with the crown. The queen and the monarchy knew that this is a group of smart guys who really, really, really keep secrets.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the logical choice for a lot of espionage work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the spies back in Victorian England were Masons because they'd already used to keeping secrets. They're already used to, you know, not revealing a lot of things to the public.
Now, we only have a couple minutes here, but let me ask you this briefly. This comes up from time to time. People say, hey, are you with the Illuminati? tell us what the Illuminati actually is.
Oh, well, as far as I know, the Bavarian Order of Illuminated Seers was what is called a clandestine lodge in Bavaria about 200-ish years ago.
Mm-hmm.
To my understanding, it was a lodge of Masons that broke that rule that says we're not supposed to get involved in politics and religion. They started very much involving themselves in politics at the time, and the rest of the Masons said, no, you guys are not supposed to do that, and severed ties with them, creating this clandestine, we're kind of going rogue group of guys. To my understanding, they were wiped out about 200 years ago.
Yeah.
But that negative stigma has stayed,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that between that and Proposition 2, which happened in the 80s in Italy, you know, there's some stories here and there that very much reflect negatively on the rest of Masonry, although in reality, their rogue groups.
Right. Well, you know, recently, I guess last year, there was some flooding at the lodge.
Yeah.
And the big, huge conspiracy was, how do we get the roof patched up, right?
Right.
Right. How do we make this happen? That's step number one on world domination, right?
Right. Let's fix the roof first.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny how people's imaginations run wild.
But as a little bit of an icing on the cake, when people take the tour, not only do they get to see the Mystery Museum, but we'll take them up and they get to see the library, the lodge room, the theater. Everybody can see for themselves firsthand what the inside of the place looks like and hopefully learn a little bit.
The renovations there recently have been fantastic. In fact, I think we should publicly thank Ticer Lewis for heading up the project.
Absolutely.
That building
made the building gorgeous.
Yeah, it's glorious. So, and it's good to go for another 100 years now. Okay, when we come back, it will be the Dark 30 hour. And once again, not for the kiddies, not for the easily offended. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to the show where the unusual becomes usual. It's called Speaking of Strange. Don't touch that dial.